Imagine the disbelief of a courtroom, a jury, and an entire community as they learn that the very man who has dedicated his life to fighting fires was, in fact, the one setting them. The arrest of John Leonard Orr exposed a disturbing double life, and his trial became a landmark in criminal justice, one that laid bare the complexity of the human mind and the devastation of his crimes. This is the story of his trial, where justice was pursued one fire at a time. This episode examines the intricate legal battle that unfolded after John Leonard Orr's arrest. We'll analyze the dual trials, federal and state, that addressed his crimes, the groundbreaking investigative techniques that provided crucial evidence, and the psychological profile that shaped the narrative of his defense. Additionally, we'll explore the impact on the victims' families, the fire investigation community, and the society at large as the trial brought the full scope of Orr's actions to light. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right, so part two, we're going to get into his arrest, the investigation, the trial, and where he is now, sitting in the same exact fucking prison, until he dies. I'm shocked he's not dead yet.
He is.
I don't believe John Leonard Orr. John Leonard Orr is alive.
Yep.
He's alive. He's 75.
He's old, but he...
I swore it said that he passed away.
Nope. He's alive. He's still sitting in the same, in the same prison.
Yep.
I swore that. Yeah, I swore that he passed. Okay. Unless it was something else I was looking at.
So, yes. So he is still alive. So by the late 1980s, whispers about a possible rogue arson investigator had grown within the firefighting community. John Leonard Orr's uncanny ability to arrive early at fire scenes and his persistence in labeling fires as arson raised some eyebrows among colleagues, but his reputation as a skilled investigator often silenced these concerns. The growing pattern of suspicious fires and the use of similar incendiary devices began to narrow investigators' focus. Orr's attendance at multiple arson investigator conferences, followed by the outbreak of fires in the surrounding areas, became a glaring coincidence. And in the world of law enforcement, there's no such thing as coincidence.
Yeah. Please don't. Not again.
Did you get sick of that?
Yes. Yes, I did. Please.
It's gonna happen, honey. Just embrace it.
That's what she said? Peggy, what?
What? Fuck you both.
Okay, so in 1991, a fingerprint was found on a piece of notebook paper used in a time delay incendiary device at a 1987 Bakersfield fire, and this became pivotal. Advances in fingerprint matching technology, again, in 1991. So in 87, they couldn't do anything. It was too new. We were fingerprinting, but we weren't able to recover fingerprints from things like this, especially paper.
Yeah, no.
Back then. Now we just, I can literally take a picture with my phone of a fingerprint and scan it and it's done.
Yeah, back then you had to have like a glass bottle,
perfect
condition, yes. Nothing broken, because otherwise if it was broken, damaged, or anything like that, forget it.
But 1991, they started to change it, and now it's insanely good.
Now it's basically magic.
I can get a fingerprint on anything. I can get a fingerprint off of our wooden table right here. And I guarantee you, I dust this place, there's fingerprints all over this wooden table. So keep that in mind. This evidence, or sorry, the print was Orr's left ring finger, which he had submitted during a previous job application with the LAPD. This evidence connected Orr to the incendiary device, providing the first concrete link between him and the fires. Once the fingerprint match was made, Orr became the prime suspect in an expansive investigation. Surveillance operations were launched, with investigators closely monitoring his movements and analyzing his routines. Investigators planted tracking devices on both his personal and work vehicles, allowing them to map his proximity to fire locations. So nowadays, all of these city vehicles and stuff, they all have tracking data on them.
I believe at this point, they could track you, but like it was a downloadable thing. Like you just had to basically let him go there, and then you just had to kind of cross reference. Now they can literally track it in real time.
Yeah, like every, because as a cop, I could literally go, I'm not sure where I am, find my last location. And they can even track you from your radio now.
Yeah.
Because when you hit the little orange button on the radio, which is your distress signal, that sends out the beacon in here. And it goes to dispatch and sends them your last location.
I have never hit that button.
I unfortunately have. Almost got shot that day.
Well, on purpose or accidentally, because I've known people that have accidentally hit that button.
Yes, that's why the new radios haven't moved. So there's no accidentally hitting it. Surveillance teams noticed peculiar behavior, such as or visiting remote areas and lingering for extended periods. In several instances, fires were reported shortly after he left these areas. His interactions with colleagues also became a point of interest. Orr often dominated discussions during fire investigations, asserting his theories and steering attention towards arson as a likely cause, even when the evidence suggested otherwise. During a May 1991 fire investigator conference in San Luis Obispo, Orr discovered one of the tracking devices on his personal vehicle. Being an idiot, believing it to be a bomb, he rushed to a police explosives range, alerting law enforcement to its presence. Investigators dismissed his concerns as a misunderstanding and reassured Orr that the device was a hoax. Unbeknownst to him, a second undetected tracking device was hidden in his work vehicle, again during routine maintenance, allowing surveillance to continue. And
I would love to have heard the excuse they gave him when he said, when they tell him, it's not a bomb, John. And he'd be like, well, what is it?
Well,
not a bomb.
From what I understand, they said that somebody was pranking him.
Oh.
That somebody randomly put it on there and it was all a prank.
Oh.
That it was all fake and everything. So they made him still believe it was a fake bomb, but that was it.
I thought I was like, what did they convince him it was otherwise?
Yeah, no,
they
just said it was a hoax, that it was a fake bomb that somebody just put there. And then they tell him, hey, bring in your vehicle for maintenance. It needs maintenance done. So he brings in the work vehicle, and while they're under there doing the oil change, they planted another bomb.
Probably told the surveillance secretary, this time, put it somewhere where he won't find it.
I mean, that was actually standard, though. You always put it at the back bumper because it was easily accessible.
Yeah.
You put it back far enough, and I'm not telling anybody to do this because it is illegal to put a bug on a van, on a vehicle, without a warrant. So, but you would put it back far enough so it can't be seen walking up, but close enough that you can pull it, because back then you did have to pull data. So you would have to do the tracking, and then you would go there, grab the device, plug it into your computer, and then pull the data. Now everything, bugs are the size of a quarter, so they're hard to see. So always check your vehicle for trackers.
Yeah.
I'm not joking, because you never know. There's psychopaths out there. I'm not even talking about law enforcement. I'm talking about random ass people, because you can get your hands on these. You go to any spy store and you can get a fucking tracker. You used to be able to buy them at Radio Shack. For those that don't know, Radio Shack was a store that quite literally sold radios, amongst many other things. That's where I bought all my first RC cars growing up. Yeah. So on December 4th, 1991, I wasn't even born yet.
When was I born?
1990.
Not even like a half hour before. He literally said...
Half my brain was shut off.
Said that I was born in 1991, which is not...
law enforcement moved in to arrest Ori outside his Glendale home. The arrest was meticulously planned to avoid any chance of resistance or destruction of evidence. Ori appeared composed and cooperative during the arrest, though witnesses later noted an air of disbelief in his demeanor. Despite the mounting evidence, he continued to deny any wrongdoing. Like, I can just imagine he's in handcuffs. He's like, how did you find out that I got away with all of it? There's no way you should have found out.
And then he's
I told you that all of my fires were arsons, and you didn't believe me.
Like, oh, Jesus, here's fuck, man. I would imagine there's a plot twist, John. We did believe you. We just thought it was you. Ugh.
We just... Really?
Yep. It's going to become a thing in our D&D now.
It is.
No!
Yes, it is.
Fuck!
Listen to Dungeons and Magi.
Yes. Pam's in a roll. Natural one.
I swear, if you just curse me for tomorrow, I'm going to beat your ass. Granted, I wouldn't
get... We don't roll D20s. Tomorrow's City of Mist. Roll D20s. You don't really... I mean, you do roll, but you don't. News of Ori's arrest, and yes, please check us out on the 26th. We will be posting City of Mist, one of our sponsored one-shots. So, news of Ori's arrest shocked the public and sent ripples through the firefighting community. Colleagues who had worked alongside him were stunned to learn that one of their own was responsible for the devastation that they had worked tirelessly to combat. The media dubbed him the Pillow Pyro, and the story quickly became a nationwide sensation. The betrayal of a trust, the betrayal of trust by a firefighter, added a layer of intrigue and horror to the case.
I mean, this is like essentially an FBI profile turning out to be a serial killer.
Yeah, yeah,
that's about the equivalent I can think of this.
Given the scope of Ori's crimes, federal and state prosecutors collaborated closely to ensure a comprehensive case. Federal charges for arson were filed first, allowing the state to pursue murder charges later for the victims of the 1984 Olay's Home Center fire. The strategy was designed to build momentum using the federal trial to establish Orr's culpability and lay the groundwork for a more emotionally charged state trial. So this is the one thing that the only reason that they were able to do a federal trial is because the ATF was involved. The marshals were involved. That was the only, cause he never crossed state lines.
No, it was all in California.
So technically the federal government should never have charged him. They had no reason to.
Yeah.
He did not do anything to any federal buildings. He never crossed state lines. The only reason that they would be able to get him is if he crossed state lines or committed something to a federal building. So the way that, I don't know how they got away with the federal charges, but they did. Not like I care because he deserves it, but yeah. The multi-agency Pillow Pyro Task Force, the PTIFA.
The PTIFA?
Yes. Composed of local fire departments, the California State Fire Marshal's Office, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the ATF, the ones that don't do shit.
Again, I'm
really... That need to be abolished.
Every other agency in here, I can see playing a part in this. I still don't get what the fuck does the ATF have to do in here? Like Villa, they don't have it's in their name: alcohol, tobacco, firearms. It's because they found out there were cigarettes in there that they were like, "This is our case."
We're the ATF. We're gonna investigate fires now. ATFF. Alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and fires.
I just don't see. It's like, were they just like, Jesus, we need to fill some spots in here. Call the ATF guys. They ain't doing anything. Because yeah. I just don't see where's the mandate for them to investigate an arson.
Can we just call for the abolishment of the ATF, please?
I'm all for that.
Daddy Trump, please abolish the ATF.
Yeah, I mean,
While Doge is abolishing other things, let's abolish the ATF because they're useless.
Yeah, I mean, all they know how to do is screw up very easy by the book raids on compounds on groups that are illegally hoarding guns. Waco. Shoot dogs.
Yeah.
And put unnecessary regulations that don't actually protect people from firearms.
On things that are being overturned, like the suppressors that we are now able to buy.
And butt stocks.
Yeah.
So
bump stocks.
Bump stocks.
Yes. You can buy a butt stock anytime.
That's what I was
asking. Bump stocks, no. Which, stupid. But, task force members cross-referenced fire patterns, analyzed ORS movements, and collaborated on forensic evaluations of fire scenes to create a detailed timeline of his activities.
And honestly, probably right around this time also, every other department in Alphabet agency that was around at that time, you have to think of when this was. There were serial Zodiac Killer was around this time.
No, he wasn't.
I thought he was.
No.
Which one was around this time? Serial Killer.
This would have been Son of Sam.
No. Son of Sam was in the 70s and in New York.
He went into the 80s, though.
Nope. The only person around this time would have been Richard Ramirez.
So it makes sense that the ATF,
The feds, in the sense of the feds, like the FBI, yes, they have a very broad range and scope of their purview of what they investigate. The ATF, it's literally in the name: alcohol, tobacco, and firearms.
I understand that, but it could have been that they hit something that pissed off the ATF.
Yeah, but just because it pissed you off doesn't mean you can just go do a retaliatory investigation. There's literally laws against that.
Yeah.
This is not in their purview at all.
No.
Even if, yes, cigarettes were used, but they control the distribution and taxation of cigarettes.
Oh, yeah. I said the cigarette thing is a joke. Yeah. That's like.
But they have no legal rights here, so I don't know.
I think they just farmed it out to them. They were like, you guys doing anything? No, we shot all the dogs. Okay, you can come on and do this. Make you feel self-important, like you're actual cops.
Yeah.
And I said what I said.
So, one of the most significant hurdles investigators faced was the reluctance to suspect a fellow firefighter investigator. Orr's expertise and professional demeanor had earned him the trust of his peers, making it difficult to reconcile his actions with his reputation. Many colleagues felt conflicted, torn between their loyalty to Orr and the mounting evidence against him. This internal struggle underscored the psychological impact of the case of the on the firefighting community. Orr's deep understanding of fire science and investigative techniques presented a unique challenge. He knew how to manipulate fire scenes to obscure evidence and create plausible alternative explanations for fire origins. Investigators had to rely on advanced forensic methods and external experts to counter Orr's attempts to exploit his knowledge. The revelation of Orr's crimes was a profound betrayal for the community he served. Residents who had once viewed him as a hero now saw him as the source of their suffering. Families of the fire victims expressed outrage, struggling to comprehend how someone tasked with protecting lives could be responsible for such destruction. The case highlighted the need for transparency and accountability within fire departments. Many departments implemented new protocols for hiring, oversight, and psychological evaluations to restore public confidence.
I'm sorry, but if somebody fails a psychological evaluation for one department, like the LAPD, then that should be a red flag to every agency within like a 50-mile radius.
Yeah.
Because if he's not sound mind and body to be a cop, how is he of sound mind and body to be a firefighter?
Yeah, at that point, just burn his application. From the moment of his arrest, Orr maintained his innocence, insisting that he was the victim of a conspiracy. He portrayed himself as a scapegoat targeted because of his outspoken personality and professional success.
You mean being a dick who has to be the center of attention for everything?
Yes. 'Cause
that's what I got from a lot of this. It's like, this guy sounds like he would just be a fucking killjoy in any conference. Like, they're just talking about random fire safety encounters. Like, he'd be like, you know that's arson, right? Like, it's like, God damn, John.
Stop being a wet blanket on a fire.
For those of you at home, we're mostly doing this to annoy Pam.
Yes.
And it's working, so we're going to keep doing it.
Him I can't do anything to. You, I can. Please don't.
You were a little delayed on that.
It's because I had to unmute. Orr's defense attorneys echoed this narrative, arguing that the evidence against him was circumstantial and that investigators had rushed to judgment. The defense focused on questioning the reliability of the fingerprint match and the interpretation of the incendiary devices. They suggested alternative explanations for Orr's proximity to fire scenes, emphasizing his legitimate duties as an investigator. John Leonard Orr's arrest marked the end of a years-long investigation that tested the resolve and ingenuity of law enforcement. It was a turning point not only in the case, but also in the understanding of how someone in a trusted position could exploit their role for personal gratification. Orr's calm demeanor and steadfast denial set the stage for a legal battle that would delve deep into his psyche and the devastating impact of his actions. The federal trial of John Leonard Orr began in 1992 in Fresno, California. Orr was charged with 3 counts of arson related to fires in the San Joaquin Valley. These charges focused on incidents where physical evidence, particularly the fingerprint match, provided a clear link between Orr and the fires. Prosecutors strategically chose these cases to avoid the emotional complexity of fires with fatalities, which would be addressed in the later state trial. And honestly, what this is this setting up 2 targets, throwing shit at the targets, and seeing what sticks. That's what this is. If they don't get him on the federal, they can get him on the state trial where he killed people.
Yeah.
The federal trial served as a critical first step in Orr's prosecution. A conviction here would establish his culpability and set the tone for the more serious charges he would face at the state level. The trial also highlighted the difficulty of prosecuting arson cases, as fire often destroys evidence. Investigators and prosecutors relied on a combination of forensic science, expert testimony, and circumstantial evidence to build their case. And again, this is why we don't see that many arsonists in jail, because their evidence usually burns away. It's not until they admit it or they get caught watching it or whatever that we actually catch them.
How many fires do you think he set?
Oh,
I think he said hundreds.
Yeah, if not close to thousands. Orr is
believed to have set nearly 2,000 fires over a 30-year period.
Yeah.
And most of them occurred between 1984 and 1991.
So looking up just real quick on here, I think the reason, and to me this is kind of a flimsy thing. Again, I think they would have just been fine doing a state court and not federal. I guess there's federal law for arson that damages interstate commerce, stores and businesses. So it's flimsy. I think it's like you said, they wanted to make sure they get them on something, so they hit them with the arson charges on the federal side because he did target a lot of businesses and stores that had to do with interstate commerce, and then the murders were for the state. Just to make sure that they, you know, they get him.
Yeah.
Because, again, it seems pretty flimsy. I don't think he... I mean, technically speaking, any business then could be considered art. Yeah,
everybody could be charged federally.
Yeah.
A pivotal piece of evidence was the fingerprint found on a piece of notebook paper used in a time delay incendiary device at the 1987 Bakersfield fire. This print matched Orr's left ring finger, which had been recorded during a prior job application with the LAPD.
They really fingerprinted this finger, too?
They fingerprint all? Yeah. All your fingers get fingerprinted.
I don't remember.
On both hands.
Yeah, they do.
You don't remember it because now it's digital.
Yeah.
They put your hands like this on a digital pad.
That's right? Right. Yeah.
They would have went like this, and then they would have told you to go like this.
Yeah.
Back then, it was... roll the finger, roll the finger, roll the finger. You're still taught how to fingerprint.
Yeah, I know how to fingerprint.
But nowadays it's digital. You place all four fingers on, it scans, then you place your thumbs on, it scans, you're done. It makes it 10 times easier.
And a lot less messy.
Yes. Yeah. No, yes. Fingerprint experts testified about the accuracy and reliability of the match, explaining how advancements in technology had allowed them to make the connections years after the fire. Investigators described Orr's signature incendiary device as a cigarette, three matches, and a piece of notebook paper bound with a rubber band. These devices were simple yet effective, designed to ignite after a delay, giving Orr time to leave the scene. Fire behavior experts demonstrated how these devices work, showing the jury how quickly they could cause a fire to spread in environments with flammable materials. And they actually brought these into court, and they used the device. So they basically, I believe they put it into a bucket, and they did the cigarette and everything, and they lit it and let it go, and you see... and they didn't put, obviously, any flammable material, but you saw it flare up, and they showed how it worked and why there was a piece of paper there and all of that. Prosecutors introduced maps and timelines showing how Orr's movements coincide with the locations and timings of the fires. Surveillance data from tracking devices planted on his vehicles further corroborated these patterns. I can just imagine him being in court and hearing, yeah, the devices we planted, the tracking devices, you go, you told me that was a bomb.
He's like, you lied to me.
You told me that was a bomb. Damn it. God. Witnesses testified that Orr was often one of the first people to arrive at fire scenes, raising suspicions about his proximity to the events. Several witnesses described Orr's behaviors at fire scenes, noting his tendency to dominate investigations and insist that fires were caused by arson, even when evidence suggested otherwise. Colleagues recounted instances where Orr displayed an unusual fascination with fire behavior, offering detailed theories about how fires started and spread. The prosecution sought to establish a clear pattern in Orr's actions, arguing that the timing, location, and methods used in the fires were consistent with a single perpetrator. By focusing on the technical aspects of the fires and Orr's expertise as an investigator, they painted a picture of a man who exploited his knowledge to commit and conceal his crimes. Prosecutors emphasized Orr's professional background, arguing that his understanding of fire science made him uniquely capable of creating fires that mimicked accidental causes. They suggested that Orr's actions were driven by a desire for recognition and validation, as he often positioned himself as a hero by arriving early at fire scenes and contributing to investigations. Orr's defense team argued that the fingerprint evidence was circumstantial, suggesting that the print could have been transferred through legitimate investigative activities or unrelated incidents. They questioned reliability of witness testimonies, asserting that Orr's presence at fire scenes was a natural consequence of his role as an arson investigator. Now, my argument as a prosecutor would be, why wasn't your client wearing gloves while he was investigating the scene?
Mm-hmm.
That is standard operating procedure when handling evidence. So, therefore, maybe he handled evidence without gloves as a backup to say that he was handling evidence, and that's how his fingerprints got there. And for anybody that's a future cop,
wear your gloves.
Wear your fucking gloves. Or please, I will find you, and I will smack the shit out of you. Same thing when searching a suspect. Wear fucking gloves, And not just latex gloves when searching a suspect. Wear thick gloves. Go buy baseball gloves. I've been pricked. And it's not fun. Wear fucking gloves.
Yeah.
The defense portrayed Orr as a dedicated firefighter and investigator who was being scapegoated due to his outspoken personality and high-profile presence in the firefighting community. They suggested that the prosecution was under pressure to find a culprit and had zeroed in on Orr despite the lack of direct evidence linking him to the fires, minus the fucking fingerprint. The defense argued that the prosecution's pattern evidence was coincidental, pointing out that the fires were common in Southern California during that time, and that Orr's proximity was a result of his job duties. Mm-hmm. Fires were common in Southern California at that time because there was a fucking arsonist.
Yeah. I think even the judge noted when in the trial, it's like, huh, you know, since you're, because I believe John Orr was, he was remanded. He did not make bail.
Yeah.
So while he was locked up for this trial, like, the fires went right here, and then they just stopped. And the judge was like, interesting. All you've been in prison in the holdup this whole time. Haven't had one fire, John. Kind of says something, doesn't it? I knew he was going to do it. Yeah, I'm loving every time he does it. I just wish I had better quips like David Caruso. Actually, what am I talking about? Probably some Hollywood writer wrote those for him.
Yeah.
And they were garbage. That wasn't
good. No.
No. Murder. That's basically all it was. Murder. Jurors were tasked with sifting through complex forensic evidence and competing narratives about Orr's behavior and intentions. The fingerprint match was a significant factor, as it provided the only direct physical link between Orr and one of the fires. However, jurors also had to weigh circumstantial evidence and expert testimonies about fire behavior and arson techniques. Unlike the later state trial, which dealt with the deaths caused by Orr's actions, the federal trial was focused solely on property damage. This allowed jurors to approach the evidence with less emotional bias, focusing on the technical and forensic aspects of the evidence. On July 31st, 1992, the jury found Orr guilty on all three counts of arson. The verdict was unanimous, reflecting the strength of the evidence presented by the prosecution. Orr was sentenced to 30 years in federal prison, a significant penalty that ensured he would remain in custody while state prepared its case against him. That is insane. Arsonists don't ever get that long, especially going to federal prison, which is where he still is. The conviction was widely celebrated by investigators and prosecutors who viewed it as a critical first step in holding Orr accountable for his actions. Victims of the fires expressed relief at the verdict, but emphasized that justice would not be complete until Orr was held accountable for the lives lost in the Olay's Home Center fire. The federal trial established Orr's modus operandi, or MO, and demonstrated his capability for arson. This provided a strong foundation for the state's murder case, which would build on the evidence and narratives presented during the federal proceedings. The trial brought national attention to the issue of arson and the challenges of prosecuting such cases. It highlighted the importance of forensic science and interagency collaboration in solving complex crimes. It also gave the ATF something to do and investigate actual crimes. The federal trial was also offered insights into Orr's psyche, with prosecutors and experts portraying him as a man driven by a need for recognition and control. These themes would become even more prominent during the state trial. The federal trial of John Leonard Orr was a pivotal moment in the pursuit of justice. It marked the first time the jury held Orr accountable for his actions, setting the stage for the more emotionally charged state trial to come. The evidence presented, particularly the fingerprint match and the analysis of Orr's incendiary devices, painted a damning picture of a man who had used his expertise to wreak havoc and evade detection for years. This trial was not just a legal proceeding, but a demonstration of the power of forensic science and collaboration in uncovering the truth. Now we're going to go on to the murder trial. After John Leonard Orr's conviction in federal court for arson, state prosecutors began preparing a more substantial case against him. This case focused on the most severe consequences of Ward's actions, the loss of human lives in the 1984 Lays Home Center fire, and the destruction caused by his broader arson spree. Ward faced 4 counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances and 21 counts of arson related to the fire set between 1984 and 1991. The state trial sought to address the devastating human and financial toll of his actions. Given the severity of the charges, prosecutors announced their intention to seek the death penalty, which obviously we know that didn't happen. This elevated the stakes of the trial, turning it into a high-profile case that captured national attention. The lead prosecutor, Mike Cabral, expressed determination to ensure that Ord would face the maximum punishment allowable under California law. And keep in mind, California does not issue the death penalty that easily.
No, there's a...
It's very rare.
Yeah.
And they've not done it for a very long time.
Well, that's for other reasons.
Yeah. The fire at LA's home center in South Pasadena, again, resulted in the death of 4 people, 50-year-old Ada Deal, her 2-year-old grandson, Matthew Troidel, and 2 employees, 26-year-old Carolyn Krause and 17-year-old Jimmy Catina. Or Satina.
Satina.
Witnesses describe... How do you know? Do you know him?
I'm just looking at... I think that's the pronunciation.
Do you know? You were alive back then.
No, I wasn't.
Anyway.
It's 1684. It's born in 88, you dick.
You were alive.
Sorry, you were born in 84.
No, I wasn't. Otherwise, I'm a lot older than I am.
Now that's the appropriate time to use it.
So witnesses describe the chaos as the fire spread rapidly through the store, trapping victims in a deadly inferno. Firefighters who responded to the scene recounted their struggle to contain the blaze and rescue survivors. Fire investigators presented evidence that showing that the fire started in a stack of polyurethane foam cushions, a highly flammable material. The rapid spread and intensity of the flames indicated the use of an incendiary device. Using advanced fire modeling techniques, forensic experts reconstructed the fire's progression. They demonstrated how Orr's signature device, cigarette matches, and paper could have ignited the foam and caused a catastrophic blaze. Survivors of the Olay's fire testified about their experiences during the blaze. Their accounts painted a harrowing picture of the event, underscoring the deliberate and deadly nature of the fire.
So, I actually found a picture of what Olay's home center looked like before. Now, these, as far as I can tell, this chain doesn't exist anymore. I don't know. I think this was a chain, or at least it might have been. I don't know, but it definitely doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it got burnt.
Well, I mean, my point was is that we look at like a lot of like a Home Depot. I always thought that this was like a Home Depot Lowe's thing.
Mom and pop store.
Yeah. So, but the layout I see of it is like it's in a shopping plaza. Yeah. Like John, they always said that John Orr, he didn't intend to kill people, but you know what? I'm really looking at the layout of this. I don't know how John Orr could have set this without knowing there were people there or anything, because this looks like just a shopping center. Like if you look at the picture there, John Orr would have had to go in there, obviously, like through the front entrance in the store. How does he not see people there?
Oh, he knows it was a busy day.
Yeah. So it's like they always said, like, some people said, like, well, he wasn't a murderer. It's like, I think he actually did try to, was trying to kill people this night, because there's no way that you can set this. It's one thing to break it in the back and then he just kind of sticks it in somewhere. This guy would have had to go probably walk by all these people that he killed.
I don't think it was necessarily that he was trying to kill people.
He just didn't care.
He didn't care. But I also think it was more to the point that he probably assumed everybody could get out.
I would. This man, whatever he is, he was a skilled arson investigator. He knew what this thing could do. I don't know how he could see, like, oh, everyone's got plenty of time. Really? He just pulled it on polyurethane foam mattress mats. He should have known this thing would have gone up like a Roman candle in less than a minute. I don't think anybody was realistically going to get out of there unless they were right at the door.
Yeah.
So.
And on that day at Olay's, he went from a arsonist to a murderer.
I have to do the glasses thing.
Yeah, I just did it in reverse.
Yeah.
Because he puts on his glasses.
I'm looking at actually like the pictures of the actual fire of it, and whole place went up. Good Lord. Like every even the surrounding areas, too. There's nothing left.
Well, they said it burned at like 800 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Orr's unpublished novel, Points of Origin, became a cornerstone for the prosecution's case. The book featured a firefighter-turned-arsonist named Aaron Stiles, who used incendiary devices similar to those Orr was accused of employing. Yes. This man wrote a book, quote-unquote, a fiction novel based off of himself.
Yeah. They actually made a movie out of it, too. HBO did. Ray Liotta.
Prosecutors highlighted chilling parallels between the events described in the manuscript and the real-life fires Orr had investigated, including the Olay's fire. Passages describing the fire's ignition and the deaths of a woman and her grandson were nearly identical to the actual events. Former colleagues testified about Orr's behavior during investigations, noting his tendency to arrive at fire scenes uninvited and his insistence that many fires were arson. Firefighters who worked with Orr described him as knowledgeable but arrogant, often inserting himself into investigations and offering detailed theories about fire causes.
It's easy to do that when you know how they all started.
Yeah.
Also, you can buy Jordan Orr's book on Amazon. I'm literally looking at it. You can buy it for $19.99 in paperback.
I'm not going to give him $20.
Nah.
I guarantee you he doesn't get the money.
It's actually against the law. Because funny enough, it's called the Son of Sam Law. You are
because not of Son of Sam. So Son of Sam published
a book.
A book. And he was making a shit ton of money off of it. And it was going, like, right into his fucking account in jail. Yeah. And he had so much commissary money. And
the victims
were like, the fuck, this should go to us. So when that happens, when you buy a book from a convicted criminal, all the money goes to the victims. So when you buy that $20, it's now going to the victims of those people. To this day.
Funny enough, it actually had some pretty decent reviews.
Too. Yeah. Even to this day, it goes to the victims. They basically put it in a fund. Even if none of these victims or their families are still alive, they'll put it in a fund and hold it for if another fire happens or whatever, then they distribute that money out. So keep in mind, if you ever want to buy anything like this, it's not going to those people. Son of Sam definitely...
He did not make any money.
Yeah. He made a lot at first. And then they took it all away very quickly. But yeah, so none of that money goes to him. We should buy it just to read it.
I mean, honestly, the reviews are like not that bad.
If only he would have stopped ours. Well, he had great inspiration. That's the thing. Could he have written more?
Probably not. I think you know what? I think he was writing this again as his own vanity thing. Yeah. And he just found it.
Yeah. I don't know if it's in here. It might be, but he said that it's nothing like what happened at all. It's all fiction.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's all fiction. The guy in here, his name is Stiles. I'm John. See, totally different.
Yes.
Wow, the paperback is $140.
And on that day, his life went from...
Don't do it.
Nonfiction to fiction.
I'm so over this right now.
We're going to get sued by fucking Paramount. They're the ones that own the rights to CSI now. Yeah. So, prosecutors presented evidence linking Orr to multiple fires through patterns in his movements and the timing of the incidents. Surveillance data and travel records show that Orr was often in the vicinity of fires shortly before they started. Expert witnesses describe the technical aspects of Orr's incendiary devices, emphasizing their simplicity and effectiveness. These devices left little physical evidence, making them difficult to trace, but their consistent design helped tie Orr to the fires. Orr's defense team argued that Points of Origin was a work of fiction and had no connection to real-life events. They claimed that the similarities between the novel and fires were coincidental and reflective of Orr's professional knowledge, not his actions. The defense suggested that the Ole's fire was caused by an electrical malfunction, not arson. They presented alternate theories about how the fire could have started, aiming to introduce reasonable doubt about Orr's involvement. And this is the thing. You don't have to win the argument. You don't have to prove that he's innocent, but you have to basically make it to where they have a reasonable doubt. Yeah. So it's guilty without a reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
So if I can put that little bit of doubt and you are not 100% confident, I've won.
I mean, honestly, I know this is hindsight and more of a dud thing, but his arrogance really came back and bit him in the ass. I mean, for all this time, he kept saying, it's all arson, it's arson. And then when they finally woke up to the fact, yeah, it is arson. You're arson, John. Suddenly he said, hey, this isn't arson. Which is it? What is it? Is it not arson? You've been saying for years that all these things are arson. And now, no, it's not arson. Not at all. It's like,
I mean, it's amazing what you'll say when your feet are held to the fire.
I didn't think he'd do it.
So many puns. It's so punny. Defense attorneys attempted to discredit witnesses, arguing that their testimonies were influenced by hindsight and the sensationalism surrounding the case. They also challenged the reliability of forensic evidence, suggesting that investigators had selectively interpreted findings to fit their narrative. Through the trial, Orr maintained his innocence, denying any involvement in the Ole's fire or other arson incidents. He portrayed himself as a victim of a vendetta, claiming that investigators had fabricated evidence to frame him. Relatives of the Ole's fire victims delivered emotional testimonies, describing the devastating impacts of their loss. Their statements brought the human cost of Orr's actions into sharp focus, moving both the jury and the audience. Ada Deal's son recounted the pain of losing her mother and young son in the same fire, calling for justice to ensure that Orr would never harm anyone again. Many of Orr's former colleagues attended the trial, grappling with the betrayal of trust by one of their own. Their presence highlighted the broader implications of Orr's actions for the firefighting profession. Some firefighters testified about the lasting damage Orr's crimes had caused to their reputation and public trust. On June 25th, 1998, the jury convicted Orr on all four murder charges and nearly all the arson counts. The one exception was a charge related to a fire at the Warner Brothers backlot, which was dismissed at the prosecution's request. And that the reason that the prosecution would request that is because they know they can't get that one. They probably did not have enough evidence on that one, and they don't want to risk not getting the rest. Yeah. So they'll ask for one to be dropped because he's already has 30 years already. Now the murders gets him quadruple life plus another 30 to 50 years for the rest of the arsons. So dropping one charge isn't going to do anything. The jury deadlocked on the death penalty, with 8 jurors in favor and 4 opposed. Split decision resulted in Orr receiving a sentence of life without parole instead of capital punishment. So in the form of capital punishment, it has to be unanimous. It cannot be split like this. Typically, for any prosecution, as long as there's a majority favoring, that happens. But when it comes to the death penalty, it has to be unanimous all the way around. Oh, yeah. So he was sentenced to 4 consecutive life terms for the murders, along with an additional 21 years for arson. His state sentence was to run consecutively with his federal sentence, ensuring he would remain incarcerated for the rest of his life.
Oh, and that's where he remains today.
Yeah. The state trial of John Leonard Orr became a landmark in arson prosecution, demonstrating the power of forensic science and investigative collaboration in addressing complex cases. It also highlighted the psychological dimensions of arson, prompting greater scrutiny of individuals in public safety roles. For the families of Alley's fire victims, the trial provided a sense of closure, though the pain of their loss remained. Community members expressed relief that Orr had been held accountable, but continued to grapple with the betrayal of trust. The trial also prompted reforms in fire department hiring and oversight practices, aiming to prevent similar cases in the future. Orr's conviction solidified his legacy as one of the most prolific and destructive arsonists in American history. His story remains a cautionary tale about the dangers of unchecked ambition and obsession. The state trial of John Leonard Orr brought justice to the victims of his most heinous crimes, the Olay's Home Center fire. Through powerful evidence, emotional testimonies, and a thorough examination of his actions, the trial revealed the full extent of Orr's betrayal and the devastating impact of his obsession with fire. While Orr's life sentences ensure he will never harm another person, scars of his actions endure, serving as a stark reminder of the consequences of unchecked darkness within individuals. So getting into his psychological profile, let's delve into this one. John Leonard Orr's actions provided a rare glimpse into the psyche of a serial arsonist. Psychologists and criminologists identified several key traits that define Orr's behavior. The first is pyromania, which is a compulsive fascination with fire and an uncontrollable desire to set fires. While Orr was never formally diagnosed with pyromania, his actions and writings indicated a deep obsession with fire as a destructive force. And then also hero syndrome. Some experts suggested that Orr exhibited signs of hero syndrome, a psychological condition in which individuals create dangerous situations so they can later emerge as heroes. This theory aligned with Orr's tendency to arrive early at fire scenes and take an active role in the investigations. Orr's actions demonstrated a need for control, both over fire itself and the circumstances surrounding it. By setting fires and then investigating them, he manipulated the narrative, positioning himself as an authority figure and even a savior. His knowledge of fire science gave him a unique sense of power, allowing him to set fires that mimic natural or accidental causes and eluded detection for years. Orr's manuscript, Points of Origin, revealed a deep desire for acknowledgement. In the novel, the protagonist, Aaron Stiles, expresses frustration when his arson crimes are not properly recognized as arson. This parallels Orr's own behavior, suggesting that his crimes were partly motivated by a need for validation. Throughout his trials and subsequent incarceration, Orr maintained his innocence and showed no remorse for lives lost or the devastation caused by his actions. This absence of accountability added to the perception of him as a cold and calculating individual. The revelation that a firefighter and arson investigator, a profession inherently tied to public trust, could be responsible for such destruction was profoundly unsettling. Orr's betrayal tarnished the reputation of firefighting agencies and cast suspicion on those who worked alongside him. Colleagues who had trusted Orr and valued his expertise were left grappling with feelings of betrayal and guilt, questioning how they had missed the signs of his crimes. Fire departments across the country face increased scrutiny in the wake of Orr's arrest. Public demanded greater accountability and assurances that such betrayal would not happen again. Many departments implemented stricter hiring practices, psychological evaluations, and ongoing monitoring of personnel, particularly those in investigative roles. Keep in mind that back then, you did not need a psych eval to be a firefighter.
I mean,
you weren't carrying a gun. That is the reason that cops have psych evals, is because they carry a firearm and all that. Back then, it wasn't needed. Now, they make sure that you do a psych eval. Orr's case became a cultural phenomenon, inspiring books, documentaries, films, and podcasts, like this one, that explored the complexity of his double life. These works delved into the psychological and societal implications of his actions, shedding light on the darker aspects of human behavior. Joseph Wambaugh's Fire Lover and the HBO film Point of Origin, starring Ray Liotta, are among the most notable depictions of Orr's story.
Joseph Wambaugh is a great author. He has done some great stuff. He's also a former Los Angeles police officer.
Both works emphasize the chilling parallels between Orr's public persona and private crimes. recent true crime podcasts have revisited the case, using our story as a lens to examine the broader issue of arson and the psychology of serial offenders. Scarlet Tavern. Orr's case underscored the need for advancement in fire investigative techniques. The reliance on circumstantial evidence and pattern recognition highlighted the challenges of prosecuting arson cases, particularly those involving skilled perpetrators. Fire science saw developments in the wake of Orr's conviction with a greater emphasis on forensic analysis, fire modeling, and interagency collaboration. Orr's case raised uncomfortable questions about the nature of trust and the potential for individuals in positions of authority to abuse their power. It served as a reminder that even those who appear trustworthy can harbor dangerous secrets. The psychological motivations behind Orr's actions sparked debates about the intersection of mental health and criminal behavior, with some experts arguing for more comprehensive mental health screenings in public safety professions, which they are now. The families of the Olays Home Center fire victims faced unimaginable loss, compounded by the knowledge that the tragedy was not an accident, but a deliberate act. Think about this. So this was set in the late 80s. He was convicted in the 90s. All the way up until this point, they were told that it was an electrical fire.
Until he was convicted in the 90s, yeah, they were just...
So for, 7 years... They believe that it was
an accident.
An accident. And then they're told it was the firefighter investigating it. Oof. Yeah.
That, I would feel betrayed.
Their testimonies during the trial highlighted the profound emotional and psychological toll of Orr's actions. Survivors of other fires set by Orr described feelings of fear and anger, struggling to understand how someone sworn to protect them could cause such harm. Communities affected by Orr's fires faced a long road to recovery. Beyond the physical destruction, there was a lingering sense of betrayal and mistrust that took years to overcome. Local initiatives such as memorials and community rebuilding efforts helped restore a sense of unity and resilience among those impacted. Orr's story serves as a stark warning about the potential for unchecked ambition and obsession to spiral into criminal behavior. It is a case study in how individuals can exploit positions of trust for personal gratification. His actions highlighted the importance of oversight, transparency, and accountability in public safety roles, prompting systemic changes in how firefighters and investigators are vetted and monitored. The fascination with Orr's case has persisted for decades, with his story frequently cited in discussions about arson, true crime, and psychological profiling. It remains a compelling example of the duality of human nature and the capacity for deception. Popular portrayals of Orr have sparked broader conversations about the motivations behind arson and the challenges of identifying and stopping serial offenders. Orr's case revolutionized the field of fire investigation, emphasizing the importance of interdisciplinary collaboration and advanced forensic techniques. It also led to greater awareness of the psychological factors that can contribute to arson, informing training and education programs for investigators. Orr's incarceration has been marked by isolation and estrangement from his family. His daughter, who initially defended him, eventually accepted his guilt and severed ties, leaving Orr with little support.
Yeah, so it's confirmed that he had one daughter. They're not sure if it was two or not.
I believe he had two.
It says two, but it never really... I couldn't find really anything about...
The other daughter?
The other daughter. It was just the one that was defending him, initially.
Maybe she's just keeping a low profile.
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, that relationship went up in smoke.
I hate you.
Despite his circumstances, Orr continues to deny responsibility for his actions, refusing to engage with the evidence against him or acknowledge the harm he caused. Orr's writings and interviews from prison reveal a man who views himself as a victim of the legal system, deflecting blame and portraying his crimes as misunderstandings or fabrications. These attempts at justification have only deepened the public's perception of Orr as a remorseless and manipulative individual.
He literally told other fire investigators, this is arson, this is arson, this is arson. now, when it's coming to bite him back in the ass, mm-hmm. he's like, no, I never said that.
It's like, John, we were in the room when you said it.
In the room where it happened.
I don't know that song.
Hamilton?
Oh, yeah. Huh? I don't know that. I like Hamilton, but I don't know it as well as you do.
How many times have you watched Hamilton?
7.
We've only watched it once.
How many times do you listen to the soundtrack?
1,000. As many times as John Orr has set fires. So, once for every fire he started. John Leonard Orr's crimes left a lasting legacy that extends far beyond the fires he set. His actions exposed vulnerabilities within trusted institutions, reshaped the field of arson investigation, and sparked critical discussions about the psychology of serial offenders. For the victims, the communities affected, and the firefighting profession, Orr's story is a painful reminder of the devastating consequences of betrayal and unchecked obsession. His case continues to resonate as a cautionary tale, a cultural touchstone, and a catalyst for change. John Leonard Orr's actions highlighted the vulnerabilities inherent in professions that require public trust. Firefighters, law enforcement officers, and investigators occupy roles of responsibility often with little oversight once they gain authority. Not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Orr's ability to evade suspicion for years demonstrated the dangers of assuming that those in trusted positions are incapable of wrongdoing. The case prompted fire departments and law enforcement agencies to re-examine their internal systems for accountability. This included developing protocols to monitor personnel for signs of misconduct or unusual behavior. Background checks, ongoing evaluations, and peer reviews became standard practices in many departments, ensuring that trust is continually earned rather than assumed. Orr's case revealed the difficulties of investigating and prosecuting arson crimes. Fire often destroys physical evidence, leaving investigators to rely on circumstantial details, witness accounts, and forensic reconstructions. His expertise in fire science allowed him to set fires that mimicked accidental causes, creating additional challenges for investigators. The need to counteract sophisticated arsonists like Orr spurred advancements in forensic technology. Improvements in analyzing burn patterns and material residues allowed investigators to more accurately determine the origin and cause of fires. Techniques for reconstructing and identifying time delay devices became more sophisticated, aiding in the detection of intentional fires. Orr's case showcased the importance of preserving and analyzing even seemingly inconsequential evidence, such as the notebook paper that bore his fingerprint. And keep in mind that that is a big thing, is because that paper could have just been at the scene. Mm-hmm. Could have been what was there when it was burned. But somebody actually going to that and going, huh, let's test this. Boom. That's how they caught him. So, Orr's apprehension and prosecution underscore the value of interagency collaboration. Local fire departments, state investigators, and federal agencies like the ATF worked together, pooling resources and expertise to build a comprehensive case, except for the ATF.
Mm-hmm.
This approach has since become a model for tackling complex criminal cases, ensuring that no single agency bears the entire investigative burden, but not for the ATF because they don't investigate anything. Orr's case provided valuable insights into the psychology of serial arsonists, helping professionals better identify warning signs and motivations. Key traits observed in Orr were a lifelong obsession with fire as both a destructive force and a source of power. Orr's desire to be seen as a hero drove him to create situations where he could demonstrate his expertise. And his ability to present himself as a dedicated firefighter while committing heinous crimes highlighted the complexity of his psyche. Fire academies and investigative training programs began incorporating psychological education, teaching recruits to recognize the red flags in colleagues and themselves. These programs emphasize the importance of mental health support, ensuring that individuals in high-stress professions have access to resources that can address unhealthy coping mechanisms or destructive tendencies. Orr's case exposed gaps in the hiring and screening processes for public safety roles, psychological evaluations, which had previously been inconsistently applied, became standard practice for firefighters and arson investigators. Departments implemented more rigorous background checks, focusing not only on criminal history, but also on personality traits and behavioral patterns that might indicate a risk of misconduct. Which is why you now, not only do you take a psych eval, you also take a lie detector test, and you take a personality test.
I can tell you those psychological and personality tests will make you go insane.
Yeah.
I took one for the Washington, D.C. Police Department. I was, and then at the end of it, I had to actually talk with the psychiatrist guy. I wanted to just ram my head through a wall.
You'll have the questions and you're not sure how to answer. Like, do you love children? You're like, yes, I love my children, but you're not sure how to answer. You're like, what the fuck do I answer? If I put yes, or I think I'm a sex offender. And then like, do you love your father? And I put no. But what are they fucking thinking? Like, so yeah, there's a lot. And then the lie detector tests that they try and hem you up on. Orr's case exposed gaps in the hiring and screening processes for public safety roles. Psychological evaluations, which had been previously... Many fire departments adopted policies requiring regular performance reviews and peer evaluations. These measures created a culture of mutual accountability, where colleagues felt empowered to report suspicious or unethical behavior. Supervisors were also trained to identify subtle signs of burnout, obsession, or unhealthy competition, preventing these issues from escalating into criminal behavior. Orr's case brought attention to the prevalence and impact of arson, which is often underestimated as a criminal threat. Public education campaigns aimed to raise awareness about the signs of arson and the importance of reporting suspicious behavior. Communities were encouraged to engage with local fire departments, creating partnerships that enhance prevention efforts and trust. The betrayal of trust by Orr emphasized the importance of creating safe channels for whistleblowing within organizations. Departments established anonymous reporting systems to encourage employees to speak up about misconduct without fear of retaliation. The revelation of Orr's crimes dealt a significant blow to the reputation of firefighting and investigative professions. Rebuilding trust required not only systemic changes, but also transparent communication with the public. Fire departments held town halls and community meetings, allowing residents to voice concerns and learn about the steps being taken to prevent future betrayals. Orr's case sparked broader discussions about the concept of heroism in public safety. The desire for recognition, while natural, can lead to dangerous behavior if unchecked. Training programs began emphasizing humility and teamwork, reinforcing that the success of a department depends on collective effort rather than individual accolades. Orr's story remains a critical case study for criminologists, psychologists, and law enforcement professionals. His dual roles as arsonist and investigator provide unique insights into the intersection of expertise and criminality. Case continues to inform best practices in arson investigation, mental health screening, and interagency collaboration. Fire academies and law enforcement training programs frequently use Orr's case as a cautionary tale, teaching recruits about the ethical responsibilities of their roles and consequences of abusing power. His story serves as a reminder that unchecked ambition and obsession can have devastating consequences for both the individual and the community. John Leonard Orr's crimes left a trail of destruction, but they also catalyzed critical changes in public safety, fire investigation, and societal awareness. His case revealed vulnerabilities in trusted institutions, underscoring the need for vigilance, accountability, and continuous improvement. The lessons learned from Orr's betrayal serve as a beacon for future generations, ensuring that his legacy is not defined solely by his actions, but also by the progress they inspired. So, despite Orr's convictions, many questions remain unanswered. How many fires did he truly set? Could earlier intervention have prevented the tragedy at Olay's home center? These questions linger, highlighting the complexity of the case. or steadfast denial of guilt leaves room for speculation by a psychological state and whether he fully understood the magnitude of his actions. So we obviously, we can estimate a few thousand.
Yeah, about 2,000.
We don't know.
What they speculate.
We don't know. Could earlier intervention have prevented the tragedy? Yes, but how would they have known?
Well,
this,
right.
This is the thing. And until he killed somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean.
It was kind of just, it was fires.
I mean, up until this point, many people in the law enforcement, firefighting, the first responder community didn't genuinely believe that one of their own could do something like this.
I mean, there's probably cases that one of their own has done something in the previous years. But it's like your first instinct is not to blame someone you work with versus a complete stranger.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you don't want to burn that bridge.
Had to get one more in.
Yes. That's what she said.
I mean, I'm sure there had been cops and even firefighters that for money had set a fire for something. Again, I mean, most people up until John Orr, most people pegged arsonists as mostly in the realm of like organized crime.
Don't.
You know, like gangland fires, people setting, you know, burning down their home or business for insurance money, things of that nature. I mean, I'm sure there were people out there who thought there were some crazies out there who just liked fire, but not to this, and definitely not a firefighter.
Yeah.
So
John Leonard Orr's trial revealed the devastating consequence of one man's obsession, but it also showcased the resilience of a community determined to seek justice. The flames he set may have consumed lives and property, but the pursuit of justice ensured his reign of terror ended with him behind bars, where he remains a cautionary symbol of unchecked ambition and human fallibility. And he is housed in
Summering, California.
Neil Creek, I thought I saw.
Double check. Yes. He's at California State Prison, Sentinella. He was transferred there in 2002. Yeah, so, and that's where he's going to die.
I wonder if he will ever just fess up, like, one day.
Nope. Maybe when he dies, but,
wants to leave this world with a clean conscience.
Yeah, so, and you talked about him being the Frito Bandito. He also had one other nickname.
What was that?
Was the Coin Tosser. Because of incorporating coins.
You're right, we did touch on that before.
Toss a coin to your witcher. Toss a coin to your arsonist.
Please don't sing. Not you, kid. You, Ben.
Sing if I want to.
You sound like a fallen fucking angel. Fuck you. Really?
Turn it back on her. So... A family fleeing in terror. A house that whispers in the dark. A crime so brutal it left a permanent stain on its walls. Was 112 Ocean Avenue truly haunted? Or was it the greatest hoax in paranormal history? Join us next episode as we unravel the chilling tale of the Amityville Horror, where true crime meets the supernatural. And the truth is far stranger than fiction. Thank you for listening. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.